Hello, how are you?
I am doing great. Thanks for filling in for Bill Scherr, who once again is on assignment.
Nice for him.
I think he's on a beach again. He always goes away to these exotic vacations. He's always, he's probably being fanned right now, being fed grapes or something somewhere. So.
Well, that must be nice. I'm here in Washington, D.C. And my name is Garance Frankie Ruta. I'm at the Washington Post, and this is the Week in Blog.
That's right. So, slow news week compared to what we've been having a lot lately, but a couple big things. I guess mainly the topic of race has been a big issue again this week. You had the NAACP meeting where they put out a somewhat of a condemnation against the Tea Party. I guess that's up for interpretation. And Sarah Palin came out. We also had Kirsten Power and Megyn
yes.
Kelly on Fox getting into it. So I don't know. What was your take? Where do you want to start on that?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the DOJ. And the case in Pennsylvania. One question that people have brought up is whether or not there's any individuals who come forward who say that because of the individuals at the polling stations, whether or not they were actually prevented from voting. And so, so far, as I understand it, no one has made the claim that they were prevented from voting. And so that's kind of an interesting fact. I thought Eric Erickson's post, I believe it was yesterday, was very interesting, talking about, bringing race back into the picture and making it an issue because the Republicans, as much as they want to reach out to black voters, aren't just not going to get them this cycle, and that it's an issue people should front on.
Well, I do think that regardless of putting the race issue aside, I mean, voter integrity, whether it's a Klan member intimidating blacks against voting or whether it's a new Black Panther intimidating people against voting. I mean, that is a very serious thing. The right to vote is so. I mean, I understand the serious, but the real question that you sort of alluded to.
The question is also, whether it's a systematic thing versus a one-off. And
when also the way the media has played it up. I mean, Dave Weigel wrote about this at the Daily Caller, saying, I mean, like Fox News has been. This, really, really highlighting this case.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
And it reminded me of, like, when MSNBC really there was a town hall meeting in Delaware with Republican Mike Castle, and I think somebody in the audience was saying something crazy, a birther or something. And MSNBC mm-hmm. ran this thing nonstop for days, and I don't think any of the other networks even ran it. So it's like, is this just selective coverage of find the most crazy things that the other side has done and focus on that? So
don't you think it's the television equivalent of what you call nut picking when you're writing a story, which is to say, going into a comment thread and finding the most outlandish things that anyone has said?
I think it is, and it's probably good. I mean, one thing to keep in mind is it probably is actually very good for the ratings as well. And I mean, I think this fits into not just sort of cherry picking sort of politically contentious things, but also the sort of the way that gossip has sort of crept into journalism. I mean, the other day there was a big story, of course, about how Bristol Palin had gotten back together with Levi Johnston, and everybody had to cover it. I mean, the Washington Post ombudsman had a big story, I guess, on Sunday about this sort of tension between, writing good stories versus getting page views and clicks. It's something we all
with. I mean, if I can just interrupt, I think, people need to remember that there has always been, a style section at most papers, or at least there have been since the 1970s, late 1960s, since most papers got rid of, the women's sections. And, there are sections at newspapers that focus on lighter topics. A lot of publications have gossip columns. And I think what happened online initially with a lot of publications is that they're more serious fare, went onto the web first and more aggressively, and now you're seeing a real sort of coming of age of this other part of the operation.
Right. But I mean, so, but the problem is, you know, and it goes, and by the way, I don't want to pick on the Washington Post. I mean, this is, everybody is facing, everybody's facing this dilemma. I mean, trust me, you know, it's every media outlet and TV. But my issue is, I mean, like, so the Bristol Palin thing, that's really should be a TMZ story, not a Fox, CNN, MSNBC story, but it is. So essentially they've taken a style story and put it on the front page or in the political section, and that's what kind of is bothersome to me. And I want to compare it to the Black Panther story in the sense that the new Black Panther story is much, much more serious, but also I do think there is an analogy between taking things that are sort of salacious and get eyeballs and pushing them, whether or not they're actually part of a trend, part of a relevant story that the consumers really need to know about.
Yeah. Well, I would just say, you know, with the Bristol Palin, Lovie Johnson getting back together story, I mean, it was broken by Us Weekly, which is a gossip tabloid, and then it was covered by the Post gossip column, so which is, you know, I don't think it's putting anything on the front page that shouldn't be there. It's just, you know, it's just online. There is no division between the sections in that way. And so, you know.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
You know, you can't flip through the sections online in that way. Everything has to go through the same big portal.
Okay, well, let me bring up a sort of different angle then. We know that sex sells.
okay.
And so,
yes,
well, I think we
do know that.
I think we know that. Yes. And so, you know, we've got this. First of all, Fox News does this segment with Andrea Tanteros, who doesn't even get to speak. You know, the brunette. We're not going to let her talk, although she is, of course, lovely. But is it Kirsten Powers? I want to make sure I'm pronouncing. Is it Kirsten or Kristen? I think it's Kirsten. You know, Kirsten Powers and Megyn Kelly get into this really heated debate. And look, I think on its own merits, it's fascinating. I mean, had that been, you know, Bill O'Reilly and, I don't know, Bill Press having that contentious argument, it would have still gotten attention. But I think it's probably beyond doubt that the fact that these were two attractive women on YouTube fighting each other got it linked on a lot of blogs.
Yeah, I wouldn't know anything about women arguing on YouTube getting linked on blogs.
So, I mean, I have no doubt
it's never happened.
Yeah. I mean, there's a Bud Light commercial about that, I think.
Well, I've heard it said that, you know, anger is to the blogosphere what, you know, porn is to the web more generally. It's, you know, everybody wants to watch. But I don't know. I will admit that I did not actually watch the full clip of the two arguing because I started watching it and I thought, you know, I have other things to do.
Well, I mean, it was so big that Sarah Palin actually tweeted, "Watch Fox's Megyn Kelly on Black Panther voter intimidation case. She knows the case. She's speaking truth. Her revelations leave left steaming." So it was a big enough deal that Sarah Palin tweeted about it. So,
well, Sarah Palin is, you know, she's using Facebook in an interesting way. I mean, she's using it kind of like a blog. You know, a blog with subscribers, a built-in subscriber base, and, you know, a built-in infrastructure for commenting and feedback, and it works for her very well like that.
It's
the difference between her blogging and her releasing these things on Facebook, I don't really see the difference except, you know, the technological infrastructure underlying it.
I put together for Politics Daily a couple weeks ago, I did these lists, the top political journalists on Twitter. You guys had a few, Chris Saliza.
Yes, we did.
Aaron Blake.
Yes, he's got a ton of followers.
And I did, you know, the top liberals on Twitter, the top conservatives on Twitter, and I did not include Sarah Palin. And my friend Alex Pappas over at the Daily Caller, you know, said, mm-hmm. "Why didn't you include Sarah Palin? She's the most, you know, she's using Twitter." I didn't include her because I don't think it's anything she's doing. In other words, I don't think that she's really using Twitter that effectively. I don't think she really interacts with people on it. It's just that people find her interesting. And so I would almost compare it to, like, you know, Kim Kardashian has a huge following on Twitter too. but that doesn't mean that she's using the medium as effectively as she might. So anyway, that's sort of an aside, but I did not include Sarah Palin, although clearly she does make news. If making news from your Twitter feed is the criteria, she should have been the number one person on my list.
It's true. She does make a great deal of news from her her online efforts. I have a question for you, since this has been the week where everyone has been writing about Palin's PAC, you know, finally raising a lot of money and spending money on candidates and developing a real sort of infrastructure that would be suitable to a potential presidential candidate in the future. Mm-hmm. Do you think that she would run? What's your take on it?
I think it's 50-50. I don't want to write it off. I truly believe that she hasn't decided yet. But I think that some of the hype, here's another example, I think, of the media kind of getting it wrong. I mean, the amount of money that she raised, it was like $800,000 in the second quarter. Now, right. that's impressive compared to what she has done in the past. It is her right. best quarter, and I think that clearly we see her improving. Clearly we see her building, becoming more professional, more polished. But by the same token, Marco Rubio, for example, raised $4.5 million in that same amount of time. Right. And so I don't think it was an amazing amount of money. I mean, look, I feel like if I were Sarah Palin, I could have raised more with all the benefits and advantages that she, I know that's a weird concept for people to grasp.
If she'd wanted to raise millions, you mean yeah. she would have been able to do that. No, I think that's right.
But the media story,
I sort of look at her and her place in politics, and you know, she's not just, I mean, she's sort of very successfully positioned herself as sort of as a post-gender candidate at the same time as she is, you know, very actively going out of her way to support female candidates and talking about that. But, you know, if you look at female candidates, and she would be trying to become the first female vice president, I mean, the first female president, you know, there's different categories of women who have succeeded at becoming political firsts, you know, the outsiders, which is how she became governor. She was the outsider. That was
right.
her sort of framework, right? You know, there's the legacy. Hillary Clinton is kind of a legacy. She gets her authority initially from her marriage and then takes that and develops her own political career. You know, there's the defender, for example. In other countries, you have ministers of defense who go on to become presidents or prime ministers. And then you have the category of party leader. And Palin, to me, after ceasing to be an outsider with the campaign in 2008, I was wondering, you know, well, which of these categories could she take on? The only one that seemed logical and available to her anymore would be as the party leader. You know, if she had been, for example, the chair of the RNC and led the party back to retaking the House, you know, as the leader of the party, then one could see, you know, her having a platform then. But right now, it seems, I don't know if her platform is big enough, even though it's really big.
Right. I think you make a good point, and it also brings to mind another thing that that bothered me a little bit, even though I was a part of this and I'm guilty of it. So last week there was a big story. Will Sarah Palin take over the RNC if Michael right. Steele steps in? Like, that story had there was no reason for that story to be a story that I know of. I don't think that she implied that she wanted it. I just think that someone came up with the idea and said, hey, let's talk about this for a few days.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I read that as a tweet, a joking right. tweet first, and then like 4 hours later I read it as a story.
Yeah, and I was on TV talking about it as well.
Yeah.
But I mean, the other thing is like the same story about her PAC. I mean, like Monday there was a huge story about how Sarah Palin's for real. Her PAC shows that she's now a major player. I don't think it does. But that was like the conventional wisdom all day long on TV. So it's just weird how these narratives get written.
I suspect you watch more television during the day than I do.
I probably do. And I'm weird because, you know, most people watch TV at night. Like, most people don't watch TV during the day. And at night, they watch O'Reilly and Hannity and Matt Owl and Oberman.
Really?
And all that.
Most people do this?
Most political junkies, I mean.
Okay.
But I'm the opposite. Like, I basically do politics all day, and then at 8 o'clock at night, the last thing I want to do is watch Keith Olbermann or Bill O'Reilly. I want to watch, you know, 30 Rock or The Office or whatever, Big Bang, something funny and light. I mean, to like get my mind off politics. So I'm like the reverse. I mean, to me, Tamron Hall is a bigger star than whoever's on during prime time because she's who I see, you know?
Yeah. I will admit that much of my information consumption is just purely online at this point. And I, you know, I watch web video, and I watch streaming web video to the extent that it's available. But
as somebody who does this for, you know, for a living, I sincerely hope the rest of the world joins you. Who needs TV, you know?
It's entertaining and sometimes very informative. And there's like, you know, there's a couple of shows that I do enjoy watching, some of the political chat shows. But in general, I just on a daily basis, you know, I'll watch when there's something on that I have to watch.
And that's the whole thing too with
on the
this
television.
This show, you know, Blogging Heads. I have my own podcast. You know, it is great that if you're a political junkie and you're obsessed. I mean, there's a podcast I listen to called Econ Talk. And it's a George Mason University economist who interviews people. Maybe there's 10 people out there who listen to that podcast. I might be one. But it's just great that, you know, whatever you're really into, you can find. But I guess the downside to that is, let's go back to the old model of the newspaper. You used to have to sort of consume information you weren't looking for. Now you can really self-select. And maybe that has caused a greater cleavage between the right and the left. What do you think about that?
I'm not sure if that's what's done it. I think it was just the partisanship of the Bush years that got everybody very head up. And now, I mean, the one thing that the new media really does in terms of encouraging partisanship is it rewards controversy with funds. And so that individuals who become web stars because they become caught up in online controversies where they do something, with Michelle Bachmann or others, you know, and I think they found themselves much more financially successful than they would have otherwise. So that certainly, you know, that rewards partisanship. But I actually sort of wanted to go back to one of your earlier points, and I was just wondering what you think about where podcasts are going at this point. Because it's interesting, like a few years ago, everybody was very excited about podcasts, and right now I feel like I don't hear about them as much.
I don't know where they're going. I mean, I tell you, I was probably late to the game. I wasn't an early adopter of the podcast. I got into them after I got my iPhone a little over a year ago. So when the 3GS came out, I switched from BlackBerry. I got an iPhone, and all of a sudden, I had an iPod. I didn't even have an iPod before. So I was like the curmudgeonly old man, so behind the times. So for me, it was simply just having an iPod that made me look into it. I was not really into it, but, you know...
Do you when you're driving to and from work or something?
No, because I don't drive to and from work, but I listen to it at the gym, and I listen to it when I metro. That's the best time, at the gym or when you're metroing.
For the podcasts.
The podcasts, yeah. So, but I love it, and, you know, I love Adam Carolla's got a great podcast. NPR's Fresh Air is one of my favorites, depending on what Terry Gross is talking about. Econ Talk, the Matt Lewis Show podcast. So, you know, but the beauty of it, I think, is so like today I did an interview with Arthur Brooks from American Enterprise Institute, who just wrote a new book about how, you know, if you're selling free market economics, you shouldn't talk about money. You should talk about the fact that it brings greater joy to more people. He's an economist and a social scientist, so he has, you know, numbers and stats to back up this theory. But, you know, if he were on Fox Business or CNBC or whatever, he would have, like, 15 seconds to really make his point. And they'd be like, okay, we got to go to break real quick, and tell me this. You know, it's that whole shtick. But he and I talked for a half hour back and forth, and you can really get into it. It's like Charlie Rose, you know. Most people don't like that stuff. Most people find it boring, long-winded. But if you're ever flipping through and you see, like, Malcolm Gladwell on, you just sit down and watch because you're going to get something interesting. And if you're really into meat, not just, you know, not just candy, but meat, intellectual meat, that podcast, I think, are a good way to go.
Yeah.
Not junk.
One point about the you know, the distinction between cable and online is I feel like a lot of these distinctions are breaking down. Sorry, my computer blacked out for a second. You know, I mean, because so many of the major cable networks have really excellent websites.
Yeah.
And because everything is now on Twitter, if you put together, as I have done, you know, a Twitter feed following a lot of breaking news sources, and then I have that synced with my Trillion, and so then it just pops up in the corner of my screen. And, you know, you find that you can actually get this amazing, you can create this amazing breaking news feed for yourself. That
yeah, and it's it definitely
everything you've
TV.
Had on television.
And then way before
you know, except for the chatter, you know.
Yeah,
and then it links direct. And then it links directly to the, you know, to the news stories with all the details, you know, instantaneously. So it's actually this, you know, you can still be participating in the television news story cycle without actually watching the television.
What's also weird is I go on every once in a while I go on Sky News, which is like the BBC of Fox. It's like Britain's version of Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's shows, and it's cool because I'm on during prime. I do it during like 2 o'clock here, but it's actually on like 7 or 8 there, prime time. And they have really cool shows where like a guy's like on the street in London. It's all live. It's sort of like Total Request Live meets Hardball or something or something like that. But they're much more web. There's more web content. They have these segments like what are people clicking on today, and they have more bloggers on it. It seems like they're a little more web, you know, web focused, web savvy.
They have amazing graphics. I watched.
Yeah.
I don't know. Were you as addicted as everybody else was to the British election results?
Not on pins and needles, but
I watched a lot of the results coming in on the BBC online, and they just had amazing web graphics with these incredible sort of virtual reality studios, like nothing I've ever seen on American television.
Right, and that's how Sky is too. It's actually better, and I'm like, why doesn't Fox News? I mean, they own Sky News. Why don't they utilize some of this? Some of these graphics and technology for us. I don't get it. Why they don't. You would think they would. But another thing I've noticed, too, is more and more people appearing on TV via Skype. You know? I mean, I got to tell you. Like,
yes, yeah, I
was on Dylan Ratigan Monday. And it was like, for me, and I live in Alexandria, Virginia, and I went to 400 North Capitol Street, you know, downtown, maybe 10 miles from my house, maybe 12, I don't know. But it probably took me 2.5 hours of my day to do a 5 to 7 minute TV hit. Between the time that you, of course, you got to do some prep work, and you would have to do that. You know, you have to do a little prep work no matter where you were taping. But I mean, but by the time the car picks you up, you get there, you get in makeup, you sit, you know, you wait, they put you. And then by the time you get home, it was like 2.5 hours of my day to do about a 5-7 minute hit. So, you know, and the other thing is you can have people around the country. I think that right now there's a big advantage to living in D.C. or New York if you want to be a pundit or a commentator. But theoretically, technology would, you know, if more and more people, if Skype becomes more sophisticated to the point where, you know, essentially everybody could have a TV studio via satellite in their own home, that would definitely be a game changer. Of course, you guys have a studio at the Washington Post, so you've already invested in this.
Yes, and it's had one for a while, and it's actually become quite a bit more sophisticated recently.
Well, it's great because you guys can have like the Washington Post logo behind you too.
Right. No, I mean, there's the stand-up shop place, but then there's an actual studio as well for, you know, interview programs and longer things and, you know, other sorts of forms.
Gotcha. Excellent. Well, you want to talk about anything else, or you want to call it a day?
Well, I just thought we should mention the golf.
Okay.
Since it has been sort of the big story of the day and, you know, is going to be so concerning to this country for so long, just everybody's on pins and needles. You know, is this latest thing going to work after so many things happen?
Right.
And you know, what's the moral integrity? I mean this is a very, very serious test. And if the moral integrity is in any way damaged, then this is going to be, I mean, that is the worst case scenario.
What's the latest that you've heard? The latest I heard is that things are looking really good.
They've shut down these valves, and so there's this, as I understand it, there's a 48-hour test to sort of see what kind of pressure exists with this new cap. And if the pressure is at the right level, it will suggest that the integrity of the well going deep into the earth is good, and that this is, in fact, just, this is it. They've actually capped the well. If the pressure is too low, that would suggest that the oil, that the well is damaged deep into the mm-hmm. earth, and that the oil is seeping into the earth and will be coming and is coming out somewhere else.
Oh, okay.
So they have these undersea robots now that are going to be scanning to see if, for example, you know, capping the well and increasing the pressure by capping it leads to oil coming out somewhere else. And that is the worst case scenario, because if it's damaged, then, you know, and you get any kind of plumes coming out elsewhere, it just creates a much greater problem.
Right.
So people, I assume, are cautiously optimistic, but they've been cautiously optimistic about a lot of things so far, and it'll just be really interesting to see, you know, the next 48 hours what they find.
We will keep our fingers crossed. It's already been a largest ecological disaster in American history, even if they do fix it. So let's keep our fingers crossed that it does the trick.
I keep feeling like on Treme they need to have a flash forward somehow to include this now. Now that they've been doing flashbacks to Katrina at the end of the last season. So.
Well, thank you so much for filling in for the ever vacationing, I pick on him, he actually hasn't been out for a long time, but for Bill Scher, we appreciate you coming on the show.
Yes, thanks so much, and thanks for having me. And
Where can people meet you? We should do it. Let's have drinks. By the way,
yeah,
where,
we'll do okay.
Let's do a plug. I mean, where, if people want to read your stuff, follow you on Twitter, how do they do it?
On Twitter, I'm The Garance, which is a relic from when I used to have a blog named that. And then online, you can find me sometimes on the Post's 44 blog.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for filling in today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Have a good day.
You too.
Take care. Bye.